Deezer Originals.
This is Defending in Numbers.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Defending in Numbers, the podcast where we take a little walk through the corridor of uncertainty, pretending to know a little bit more about football than we really do. And helping me pretend this week is the most electrifying man in all of football statistics, George Elek. How are you doing, George?
Good, mate. How are you?
I feel like I haven't seen you for so long.
I'm so happy to be back. Can't believe it. I think it was only a week off, but that is a week too long.
What a reunion.
I know.
It's emotional. And then we are joined by Mo Money, Mo Problems, Mo Butt. Mo, how are you doing? Your first time?
I'm feeling great. Really ready to get stuck in and do some defending in numbers.
And I am Rob Armstrong. And I am also a subscriber to the podcast because I like listening to myself. And I subscribe to it on Deezer. I subscribe on iTunes and all the places where you can get podcasts. I also sometimes make fake names and rate and review and subscribe on iTunes, like you all should do. Boost the algorithm. Speaking of algorithms, let's move to the week by numbers.
The week by numbers.
All right then, party boys, who fancies a huge number to start us off? They both say yes, really loudly.
Who's talking to the listeners?
They're all party boys as well. Boy listeners.
Who doesn't love a huge number? Let's go for it.
Right, party on down. For 8,893. Romelu Lukaku's age in days. That's how he actually writes it, by the way. 24 years, 127 days, which makes him the fourth youngest player to ever reach 90 Premier League goals, which is ridiculous. I cannot believe how young he is. He's up there with the best of them, but the only ones who have done it younger is Robbie Fowler, Michael Owen and Wayne Rooney. And of course, I mean, Romelu Lukaku did the rounds a little bit before he, you know, made his way and established himself as a first team. He was at West Brom, he was at Everton, obviously he was at Chelsea and they loaned him out. He's been all over the place. How good is he to get to that number already at the age of 24?
I think you've hit the nail on the head a bit there with where he's been before. I think that's a huge factor in it. I'm also glad we're talking about this number, unlike the some of the press that's been around the last couple of days, to wear a slightly different number. So it's good we're covering something a bit better. But he's obviously brilliant. He's got his kind of second big move of his career. The first one to Chelsea didn't work out. If you look at his stats this season, he scored 5 Premier League goals from his 18 shots taken inside the box, which is a pretty good ratio. And some people who criticise him say he misses a few good chances in order to score a good one. But if he continues at that rate this season, he's going to score a hell of a lot of goals. Only Harry Kane, I think, has had more shots inside the area so far this season. Lukaku scored more. He's an absolute monster. He's young enough to be doing it for the next kind of 6 or 7 years. I had some doubts about him early on, but I think that so far this season he's proving me wrong.
And he did that deliberately as well.
I know.
He chose you.
He listened to the pods, I think, in the first week.
That electrifying after all.
Yeah, he's. I don't think he's as good as... I don't think he'll ever be one of the best players in the world, but I think he'll capably lead the line for United for the next 5 or 6 years.
Mo is the youngest foreign player ever to do it in the Premier League. Do you rate him?
I rate him hugely. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, you look at the three players that did it. I mean, Rooney, Owen and Fowler, you know, they're all Scousers, all, you know, young lads come up in the Northwest clubs. And This guy came in from Belgium when he was like 18 years old, 17 years old. You know, he's been bounced around the league. He's gone to West Brom. He had to prove himself in a number of teams, which, let's be quite honest, aren't really that good. You know, Owen and Fowler did those numbers playing for Liverpool. Rooney did those most of it playing for Man United. You know, those are huge clubs. Lukaku has only just joined United. I mean, he's got 6-6 or 7-7, I think, to start the season already. But, you know, most of that stuff has been done playing for mid-table clubs. It's really impressive what he can do. And the thing is, what's so crazy about him is that he's still improving. There are still areas of his game where he can massively make improvements. Everyone talks about his first touch, and okay, sometimes sure, but I think his ability to finish on his right foot on the first time, when he measures it on his right foot, he's okay. He has to be able to finish first time with his right foot, like against Real Madrid in the Champions League, in the UEFA Super Cup, sorry. You know, there's so much more to be improved. He could be one of the, like, not the best player in the world, but definitely one of the best strikers in the world. I mean, he could easily start hitting 30 goals regularly every season playing for Man United.
I do think, you say it's more impressive. I think coming through at kind of being a big fish in a small pond at maybe smaller clubs is probably a benefit rather than a hindrance. I think the fact that the likes of Fowler and Owen, kind of maybe not as much Rooney because he was at Everton, managed to kind of come through at that young age and break into these kind of more elite teams is possibly a more impressive achievement. But then I think Lukaku, as was seen by the fact he failed to do so at Chelsea, is a better player for it.
What have we learned from this? Scousers peak early.
Well, I mean,
he'll be
hoping he doesn't have a career like those guys. They're all burned out by 25.
Correct.
You know, he'll be okay hoping he can keep going. And by the looks of it, he'll think he can do so.
He's already showed more longevity than all of them, really. And he's got the big move to Man United as well. Do you reckon, how long do you reckon he's staying in the Premier League? Because everyone talks about Harry Kane taking that Shearer record, but I would have thought Lukaku is probably looking pretty good to take a Premier League goal scoring record at some point as well, isn't he?
He's going to have to compete with Kane, I guess. I don't see him necessarily leaving United. I think there are certain players, I mean, obviously Latin American players, South American players, you think eventually Real Madrid and Barcelona are going to go, hey, guys, and they're going to answer the call. But with Lukaku's Belgian, he's really good friends with Pogba. He seems to have settled down in the northwest of England. I don't see, unless Mino Raiola decides to, hatch a plot, I don't really see any massive move coming for him. You know, United are big enough and financially powerful enough, they can just keep paying him more and more money, renewing him as and when it happens.
I think Kane is more likely to go, I'd have thought, out of the two, yeah. Eventually. Also, because the wage structure at Spurs, he's eventually going to get his head turned. And now that United have got, I think United was probably the most likely destination for Kane, and now they've got Lukaku, he'll probably be somewhere on the continent.
Right, talking of wage structure, let's go to George's appearance fee today. 350 million, which is the current value of Everton's squad in euros, which is the same as Bayern Munich. Someone called Nick Harris said that on Twitter at Sporting Intel. He's got a massive plug there that's going to change his career.
But they find themselves huge
change in his career coming. They find themselves in the relegation, though. Obviously, Bayern Munich are Bayern Munich. Everton are languishing underneath West Ham, even. Koeman, surely he's under massive pressure now.
Yeah, I would say enormous. But part of it, we have to be a bit generous with Ronald Koeman here. As much as they have been pretty abject to start the season, they've had a very hard run of games. And the fact they got a point out of Man City at all is pretty impressive, although they tend to be Man City's bogey side. But, United, Arsenal, Chelsea, these are not easy games. So you have to sort of almost forgive them a little bit, throwing at Arsenal, Spurs. You've got to almost forgive them a little bit, their failures so far. But they have bought poorly in the summer. I mean, as much as they bought well, they've also failed to address the key needs in their attack of a striker and pacey wide players. They just look like the most predictable pedestrian side in the world. I mean, they look like anyone could just get on the pitch and run with them.
Is that a personal dig?
I think you'd pay for anyone in the Premier League.
I'm quick.
I could say myself then, maybe. I could get out there and run with the best. I mean, Rooney, honestly.
I think they've been very poor. And I think that you mentioned the City game, but obviously they got lucky but they had the red card there, which benefited them. The City still absolutely dominated them second half with 10 men. If you look at their kind of transfer strategy, I think that the glaring omission, which is so clear, is how can you spend all that money and not replace your best player? If you're talking about squad values, in terms of importance to the club, Lukaku basically just was more important than their 10 other most consistent starters last year. So to not bring in a striker who can lead the line, I mean, they showed last season that they had the team who could cater for a striker to score lots of goals. And, the signing of Keane and the signing of Pickford will probably in the long term be good ones. But then if you look at, Klaassen could come good, Rooney, Sandro, these aren't players who are necessarily going to improve that team, and certainly not in the calibre of Lukaku. So whilst Mo is right, it's been a very hard start for them. I was very surprised in the summer when you had people saying that they were winning the transfer window and they were doing all this good business, because it all seemed pretty shambolic to me, and it's going to take a big drop from Koeman to turn it around. And you can see in his interviews now, he's saying, I don't know what people thought, we need time, but he's been there for 18 months. He will have done in a couple of months' time, and they really need to steady the ship, because I can't really see them finishing seventh at the moment.
All right, next number. Number 43. And that's the number of crosses Spurs attempted against Swansea. That Wembley hoodoo. I know they beat Dortmund in the Champions League, but that doesn't count. They're still alive and well. Still not won there in the Premier League. And it looks like it's really genuinely playing on them. Swansea should not be getting a result at Spurs, really. I think realistically, they were celebrating like they'd won the game at the end. So, Mo, do you think Spurs have let this Wembley thing get to their head, or is it just the way teams are setting up when they play away?
I think it's definitely in their heads. I mean, you say what you want about the Dortmund game, and okay, they did very well to win that game, but Roman Bürki let two absolute ridiculous goals in from Harry Kane and Heung-min Son. Like, those were shots were just like chances at the near post, and if he just stands up, he saves both of them. He basically fell to his knees and they both went in. Without those goals, they lose that game. Spurs, I don't know, man. It's hard. There's something wrong. There's fundamentally something wrong with them. Obviously, we've talked at length about home advantage and what that actually means. Other people have written on it extensively, getting to know the dimensions of the pitch, just where you are by the sight lines on the crowd. But whatever it is with Spurs, they don't look comfortable at Wembley. And you can tell by how well they actually play away from Wembley that it's the problem is purely mental. It's purely when they go there, it's like a different kind of away game.
Yeah, I mean, I think Swansea deserve some credit for their defensive performance. I mean, they offer absolutely nothing going forward at the moment. I mean, their shots on target ratio is absolutely awful. But Clements obviously got them now set up in a way where they can restrict shots. You talk about the crosses, and I think that we're seeing, I mean, Aurier should improve this in time, but you're seeing just how much they're missing their attacking fullbacks. We see across Europe consistently, the elite European clubs rely on their fullbacks to basically play as second wingers, and you have kind of two at the back with a man sitting in front. And you say they had 43 crosses. There were just 7 completed take-ons from Spurs in that game, with I think Swansea had 10. And that just shows kind of the lack of penetration they've got as well. And if you look at the 26 shots they had, only 8 were inside the area. So you can see there's just an absolute inability to break down two banks of four, which is, you know, reminds me of Liverpool's troubles under Klopp in the last couple of seasons. And not having those players who can cover the flanking and penetrate from deep is what seems to be really hurting them at the moment. And the return of Rose will help, and they need to integrate Aurier into the team, because whatever people say about him, and he's a decent enough player, Trippier is not the man you want playing at right back when you're taking on a team who are playing with two banks of four.
How do you reckon they'll do it, the mini, very far away Wembley this weekend against West Ham? Fortress London Stadium.
I think it'll be a tennis score, I thought.
This is the sort of thing that's the sort of game where they'll thrive. You know, West Ham will probably come out and play and then just expose themselves to the counter-attack. Spurs are very good on the counter-attack, and it's not Wembley, and I think there's just a problem with them.
To be
Wembley.
Fair, it nearly is.
It nearly is. It's close enough, admittedly. Yes, it's close, but it's still not Wembley, you know. They can pop down Westfield afterwards and everything. I think that's probably the best possible game Spurs could have had right now is West Ham, because it's, and away as well, because it's not an easy win, but West Ham are such a mess right now. It would be a very good chance to get a win, but they need a win in the Premier League at home, and I don't know where they're going to get it, really.
I'm going to be shaking my fist at you about 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon, cursing you. Anyway, next number, 34.8 kilometres an hour, and that's not just the speed I'll be shaking my fist. It's Gareth Bale's top speed against Real Sociedad for their goal the other day. Breezed past the defender, chipped it over the goalkeeper, and it was kind of like that Copa del Rey goal in the final that was just ridiculous, where we all thought, yeah, Gareth Bale has arrived. Is this the beginning of him sort of getting over those injury problems? Because do you remember when Fernando Torres was at Liverpool and he had that hamstring injury, I think it was, and it was kind of the end of when he was brilliant? I was thinking a little bit that might have happened with Gareth Bale and the few injuries he's had over the last couple of years at Real Madrid, but when he went off like that against Sociedad, it seemed like, oh, he's not scared to sprint.
I'm not convinced.
A problem sometimes.
I'm not convinced there's been any indication. I mean, being scared to sprint is one thing. There's been no indication of Bale's injuries impacting him too much as a footballer, I don't think. Certainly not so much as an athlete. I mean, you use Torres as an example. And Torres, before his injury, he was absolutely explosive. He was rapid. And then you look at the kind of the pensive, lumbering player that, you know, ended up going to Chelsea and is now at Atletico Madrid. He's a completely different player. He may have value, but he's not the player he once was. Bale's never lost that. Bale turned 28 this summer. He should be in the absolute prime of his career. The fact he can still, you know, go at that pace. If you look back to just a year ago, people were saying that he was kind of now the main man over Ronaldo. So it's obvious, I mean, how quickly things can change. The rise of Asensio is obviously something where the Real Madrid fans would far rather see him on the pitch over Bale, which is an issue for Bale, because I think that Benzema and Ronaldo are basically, they're going to be starting when they're fit, in effect. So that's going to be a problem for him. But I've got no question at all that when he's fit, he would slot straight into any team in the world, and he's still got a couple of good years in him. Whether or not he can maintain that level of fitness is anyone's guess, really.
Well, that's the problem with Gareth Bale. It always has been. I mean, the reason, like you say, he was at the end of 2015-16, he was the one that powered them to that Champions League final. He was probably behind Isco and Modric, their best player in that final. Cristiano Ronaldo looked to be, for all his goals, he was looked to be a faded force at the end of 2015-16. Then Gareth Bale, injury struck, and he was terrible in 2016-17. There's no, that's not mince words. And he was basically on the sidelines, and his injury forced Zidane to play Isco, and that basically gave Madrid a whole new lease of life, turned them into the best team in Europe, and allowed them to have their best season since the 1950s. You could forgive people thinking, oh dear, Gareth Bale's on the outs, but Zidane's always shown faith in him. Florentino Perez has always shown faith in him. He was Florentino Perez's big signing, remember? That's the, you know, Cristiano wasn't Perez's guy. Bale was Perez's guy. So they've shown faith in him, and look, he showed here, physically, he's not lost it. But the problem is always, stylistically, does he really fit Real Madrid? You know, this new Real Madrid with Isco, no, not really. Asensio is more akin to that. And as George hinted at, Madrid fans prefer Asensio because he's young, he's Spanish. And Bale, even when Bale was brilliant, Bale always looked out of place at Real Madrid. It was only really under Rafa Benitez where he looked like, okay, I know what we're doing. I'm the head of this Madrid side, because he's always had a kind of dodgy technique. He can't really dribble anybody anymore. He just runs past them with pace and power. And Madrid want a bit more pizzazz, you know, as much as, you know, and that's always been Bale's problem. And, you know, he may never win the fans over, but he could definitely still stay and play. Like Joel says, he's brilliant. He's absolutely fantastic. And I think he'll stay for years to come. He's determined to not return to the Premier League with his tail between his legs. So I think he'll stay at Madrid for a while, yeah.
Surely no one's ever been booed having scored the important goals that Bale scored for Real Madrid. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable. He scored some of the biggest goals in their history, basically, in the last...
But they don't really, like, you see it online a lot, they really lay into him, don't they?
Yeah.
Every time he gets an injury, they're like, good, get rid of him.
Yeah, well, they lay into everyone, man. The Bernabeu is a very strange atmosphere. They lay into Cristiano Ronaldo, even though as he continues to score goal after goal after goal and, you know, win them trophies. But yeah, they're just a very, very demanding crowd. And the thing with Cristiano is he's obviously declined in many aspects of his game except goal scoring, and they sort of feel like, well, you score goals, okay, fine, but what else are you going to do for me? You know, it's a very, very, very demanding atmosphere.
Just whilst we're on Madrid, I just wanted to, I mean, it's not quite stats based, but I just wanted to draw attention to my favourite ever Ronaldo moments. There have been a few where he managed to argue with the goal line technology third official during the Champions League last week, which is just brilliant. I mean, the ball comes down, the guy looks at his watch, he says no goal, and he's still at him saying it was a goal. I mean, only Cristiano could argue with technology, I think.
It's like the when you're playing FIFA with someone and they're convinced that they're not offside. It's like, no, a computer has decided this.
The game is not out to get you. You're offside.
This is a fact. And another fact is that it's taken Paulo Dybala 100 games to score 50 goals for Juventus. 52, actually, because he got a hat-trick this week. His second in a row. How good is Dybala? Is he like Messi's second coming? Or is he just going to be one of many good young strikers coming up in Europe?
I'm sure Mo's going to agree with me that there's no point in saying Messi's second coming.
Yeah, there's no.
You can say that about everyone. You can say that about Mo Salah when he was young.
There's no second coming of Messi. He's best player in the world, probably the best player of all time. There's nothing. But look, what you can say is, and I wrote an article like this the other week, is that Dybala is never going to replace Messi in truly, but he could be his successor at Barcelona, purely because if you look at the way he plays, it's basically like Messi. This is why I don't understand why Barcelona want to pair them together. It doesn't really work. They do the same thing. Argentina, Jorge Sampaoli is obsessed with doing this for Argentina right now, and it's not working because they do the same thing, essentially. And even though he's played 3-4-2-1 to accommodate these two as two number 10s, it doesn't work. And, you know, but you look at the stats, right? Look at the numbers. In terms of goals, assists, chances created, and take-ons across Europe's top five leagues since Dybala moved back to Serie A, which I think is 2014-15. Since then, only three players appear in the top 10 across Europe's top five leagues for all those stats. That's Messi, Neymar, and Dybala. Now, Dybala's not as high up as Messi and Neymar. Messi is number one across all stats. Neymar is just a bit below him a little bit, and Dybala's a bit below him. But you can tell Neymar was Barcelona's succession plan for Lionel Messi. He's left. The new succession plan is going to be Dybala, I think. Once Messi moves further back into midfield, yeah, they'll probably look to get Dybala off Juventus. Juventus has shown they're willing to sell for record fees. And Dybala will take Messi's place in the final third. And I think he's a very good player and he'll be great, but no one's going to be Messi. It's impossible. It's an impossible standard to live up to. No one can do that.
On that Messi, I mean, I think, for just quickly, I think Dybala's absolutely unbelievable, and he's the player that, you know, we spoke about Lukaku earlier and said, how good can he be? Dybala's the guy to ask that question of, because he's the one guy at the moment who's a little bit older than that kind of Dembele and Mbappe age group, who's just that little bit older, that bit more established, who could go on to kind of win Ballon d'Ors in 2 or 3 years. But you say that Messi's continuation back into midfield. Haven't we seen under Valverde that's kind of stopped? Like, his passing stats are down, he's playing further forward, he's not kind of dropping deep as he was last season to kind of collect and go.
Yeah, I think that's a function of the team, though. I think it's a function of the team's dynamic. Valverde knew basically from when he took the job that Neymar was leaving, although they didn't tell us that Neymar was leaving until it actually happened. But I think what he's done is, okay, the whole reason Messi could play so far deep last season was because Neymar was essentially doing what Messi did in the final third, take-ons, creating chances, etc. There is no player like that anymore. I mean, yeah, Dembele is very good, but he's not Neymar.
And De La Feu is not Neymar.
Yeah, De La Feu is not even Dembele. De La Feu is barely a footballer. So, you know, they need Messi in the final third. Luis Suarez isn't really adapting very well. So it's clear he has different ideas about what to do with this system. But I think eventually Messi is going to... He's basically playing like a number 10 right now, if you look at him. He completely runs across the pitch.
Yeah.
And the eventual idea is, I think, I assume Barcelona, once they accept that Iniesta is not what he was, even close to what he was, I think they'll switch to 4-2-3-1. I think pull the other central midfielder deep next to Busquets, and then have Messi just as a permanent number 10, have a number 9, then have two wingers either side. I think, actually, had Coutinho been signed for Barcelona this summer, I think that would have happened probably this season. I think that's probably the long-term goal, but without Coutinho, you can't really make the system work.
It's interesting how Mo and I both said that Dybala wasn't a Messi number 2, and then the conversation on Dybala has just turned into one about Messi.
94.2% of his goals have been with his left foot. Does that mean he's a one-footed, useless knobhead, or does it mean he's just really, really good with his left foot?
I say he's one-footed, really good, I mean, serious number 10. I've never met the bloke.
You look at those two goals against Barcelona in the Champions League last year. I mean, they were absolutely sumptuous. Especially the second one, just the technique which he hit it. Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the fact that he's only scoring those goals with one foot, that's another reason why. I mean, for example, Messi is obviously one-footed, left-footed, but you've seen how many goals he scored with his right, especially how many chips he scored with his right. That's just another one of the unique things that no one can do. But yeah, it is ridiculous. Yeah, he's not Messi. Oh, but actually, here's how he compares to Messi, and here's how he could be the replacement for Messi. Yeah, it's one of those things. He could literally, physically replace Messi in the Barcelona side, but no one can actually do what Messi yeah. does. You know what I mean?
It's just he could literally, physically replace him, conjures up some very weird images of Dybala just turning into training one day and just pretending to be Messi.
But I am Messi. Love me now.
Right, I'm doing some maths on my two hands. I think it's bad maths. But 94.2% of 52 goals, does that mean he scored just over one goal with something that wasn't his left foot?
I mean, I doubt it was his head either. So
he scored a goal and a bit with his right
just
foot.
Just his chocolate leg, yeah.
All right, well, as embarrassed as I am about my maths, it's time to move on to I'm embarrassed to ask. Oh, God, I'm embarrassed. I can't even say it.
I'm embarrassed to ask.
What would happen if the league stopped right now? Because Man City and Man United both have 13 points, identical records so far, same goals scored, same goals conceded, same wins, same draws. So where's the trophy going?
Well, I mean, conversely to normally in this section, it's a question that kind of everyone's asking, but at the moment you're the only person asking this. I've looked...
But what if there's only a five-game season?
Exactly. I think it's because something to do with having over 30 games left this season means that people aren't really wondering yet. but I've done some research into it, and with certain success, I looked in the Premier League rule book, and clause C7 states if
my favourite clause,
if any two or more clubs have scored the same number of points, have the same goal difference, and have scored the same number of goals in league matches in that season, they shall be deemed to occupy the same position in the table. So as far as I can tell,
so no one wins
or everyone wins. You know, I don't want this to be gospel. I'd assume that if one of them already won the league, that they would retain it, I guess, in a kind of Ryder Cup way. But I just don't know. I mean, that is as far as I got. I think this is maybe something that's unprecedented. I'm sure, actually, it is something that's unprecedented. I don't think it's ever happened before. It's something that I think nearly happened last season between a couple of clubs a bit lower down.
Arsenal and Liverpool
with a couple of games to go. With one game to go,
it was possible, and then the
so
results.
So there obviously is a precedent to it. I cannot tell you whether or not there would be a playoff. I can't tell you whether or not there'd be a shootout at dawn. I can't tell you if it's mathematical. But to start with, they would both be deemed to come first.
I mean, you can't, two things can't occupy the same space at the same time. That's basic metaphysics. Come on now, Premier League.
Except if you literally physically replace Messi.
They both come one and a half.
Dybala can do it, but no one else can. I think it would be very much playoff time. I think the Premier League
is that the official jingle.
You can just imagine the Premier League bib is going, yes, 39th game card last, and it'll be
Schooner boys staying up at night waiting for it to happen.
I thought we'd ban that number. We don't want to talk about that.
It would absolutely happen. I think if it would be unprecedented. You can't have two teams win the same thing. I know the English football mentality of accepting ties, accepting sharing trophies went out when they stopped sharing the Community Shield. No one's going to accept that. Everyone will want a winner. And I think a playoff between the two of the sides at a neutral venue would just be just money. Just imagine selling it, you know, to selling the global rights to watching this. Oh my goodness, here's the 39th game. It's a playoff. It would just be enormous.
Would it still be as exciting if, say, Huddersfield finished 18th and Brighton finished 17th and that won the same and they had to have a 39th game to see who stayed up?
I think that would be exciting, actually.
And it took place in Thailand.
Huddersfield are great to watch, but I'd like to see that, you know.
Yeah, it was a bad choice. I was thinking of two promoted teams. But I mean, there must be something beyond that. It's not written in the official rule book, but obviously, especially considering there was going to happen last season, you'd guess that that there is a means, and probably it would be a playoff to decide who won the league. But I think we can probably agree that it's fairly unlikely to happen.
Do we have the best sort of method for it over here? The best...
Evidently not.
Because like La Liga, they use head to head, don't they? Between the two sides,
it's head to head between the two sides until the head to head is played, it's goal difference, and then once the two teams will play each other twice, head to head comes into effect. That sorts out so many decisions all throughout the season. The head to head records, I like that. It's a good system, although it can have the effect of reducing the league season down to two games, especially if you're like when Barca and Madrid had that duopoly thing going on. They kind of have it going on again now, but before Atletico Madrid rose up, it was like the two Clásicos. This is the game that decided. Of course, in 2009-10 it literally did, and 2006-07 when Real Madrid won the league in goal difference on 2006-07 because they got a draw at the Camp Nou, and then in 2009-10 Barca won La Liga by 3 points, but it was essentially the two Clásicos which settled the tie. So you know, it'd be interesting to see if the Premier League could adopt the head-to-head rule. I think it'd be quite would raise the stakes for certain big games.
I think there's scope to do that. I mean, I think the goal difference will never go, but even if it was maybe if goal difference is level, then the goal difference in your head-to-heads or something like that, to make it, because I think there's absolutely no harm in keeping the, you know, making the games between the teams around each other higher stakes, because they should be. I think that, you know, whilst it may seem to us watching on the TV or watching at the ground that, you know, United City is a bigger game than the rest, and obviously you're taking points off each other, but it's still a game for 3 points, 1 point, 0 point, depending on the score. And I think that having that increased importance as to how much you win by and the likes of it for those games would maybe add yet more drama to the Premier League.
More drama. More confusion. In our next segment, my God, that was smooth. Who's this fella? What a clunky segue.
Who's this fella?
Right then, friends in the room and listeners. Mario Lemina. Talk to me about him. He's at Southampton now. He's another sort of young midfielder alongside Oriol Romeo, who might not even be young anymore, but I remember him being young at some point. He's come from Juventus, which means he's probably won loads, and I wasn't really aware of it. He must have won a couple of Serie A titles and a
couple of doubles,
Coppa Italias and stuff.
A couple of couples, yeah.
Is he actually incredibly experienced and really, really good? Have they got an incredible deal there, or is it just sort of one of the leftovers from a very good Juventus squad?
He's a weird one. I mean, he's not. He's a good player, but he basically
but he's a weird bloke.
No, he did well at Marseille when he was young, and he went initially on loan to Juve, and then they up for a year. And then they got him in on a full-time deal, where he was only there for a year again. He only made 29 Serie A appearances for Juve. So it's fair enough that you don't have necessarily heard of him, even though he was part of those squads who did so well. He's a very versatile player as well, which I think is another reason why maybe he hasn't made the grade at Juve. He's a player who is comfortable in the middle of the park. He actually played, I think, for Bielsa in a back three as well at Marseille. He can play at full-back. And I think being that utility player, as we've seen with many, many players, especially probably at Man City, being brought in to cover a number of positions can end up meaning you just basically rarely play, and it may not be because of his talent. If you look at his kind of position playing for Southampton in the middle of the park, you know, the likes of Pjanic, and you know, it's going to be very, very hard for him to break into that Juve team in the last couple of years. I think it's an interesting signing for Southampton because it's a bit of a shift in their kind of transfer philosophy. I think they brought in a player for 15.5 million, which I think is a club record fee for Saints, and it shows that they're maybe not buying to sell anymore. And this is a guy who's 24 years old, could well have a really important career ahead of him. And anyone who watched the game on the weekend that was on Sky against Crystal Palace would have seen a player who kept it very, very tidy, didn't really do much on the ball, just kind of sat deep and was passing either side. And I think that could be misleading. I think he's got a lot more to his game than that. He's more dynamic than that. He will, you know, look to break forward more often. But I think maybe he knew that was the role they needed him to play in that game, and his versatility again was his biggest strength.
I think there's a lot of similarities to Oriol Romeo actually next to him. You know, Romeo was a part of those great Barca teams under Guardiola while actually not being a part of them. He was just sort of a backup player, squad player. He was there and about thereabouts. So he's had experience of a winning locker room without actually being part of one. Lemina's the same sort of thing with Juventus. I think, you know, there's theory that, you know, you could play them together, because obviously the thing is, you know, Lemina technically, yeah, he loves a tackle, so he can play the defensive midfielder, get stuck in the Premier League, that kind of thing. But also he can move the ball forward. He can dribble with the ball. He can play passes. He can, you know, he can try interesting things and move the ball forward. So you could theoretically play them as a two and actually have Lemina occupy a very different role. Certainly in some games he can just, like George says, keep it tight like he did at the weekend. But also in some games he can, as he gets more confident, more settled inside, he become more expansive and add a bit more of a new dynamic to Southampton's midfield. Of course, it's not really the player Southampton needed to buy. They needed to buy a consistent goal scorer. But you know, with him now, they're also insured now, because now if Romeo gets injured, they're not going to be, it's not a disaster for them. They can plug Lemina in Romeo's role, and he could do a decent job there. But then also when everyone's fit, they can play them together and have a very, very solid basis to free up their attacking players, as it were.
I do think that whilst I agree with you that they do need a striker, and you know, Austin's Obviously will not be fit for much of the season, you wouldn't have thought, even though he is now, or ish now. But I do think they did need that kind of multi-dimensional midfielder. Because if you look at the midfielders they've got Stephen Davis, they've got Oriol Romeu, they've got James Ward-Prowse, who are all consistent performers. You know exactly what you're going to get with them, though, and I wouldn't say they're going to provide anything particularly extraordinary. Whether in Lamine, you've got that player who can do that sitting role, can keep it simple, or can be more expansive. So I think he'll add something important to them. I think that the fact he's not a household name combined with a club record fee means it's quite a weird transfer looking from the outside, but I think it's a bit of a coup, and he'll certainly be I think far better known in the Premier League in a couple of months' time.
Where's Lamina's ceiling? Is that a phrase? Where's his ceiling? Where's I think it is. Where's his ceiling? Is it just going to be Liverpool like the rest of the Southampton players, or is he going to the top at some point?
This is a guy who trained at Juventus for a year after they won a double and forced their hand to spend 10 million euros on him. So his ceiling is going back to a club as big as Juventus, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, he's never going to be one of the best midfielders in the world, but he could easily be, one of those, a genuinely top sort of 10 midfielder in a top league, you know? So he's never going to make everyone go, oh, wow, yeah. But, you know, and like you said, he'll just end up at Liverpool anyway, because he'll play really well. And then Jurgen Klopp will go, I like him, let's sign him. And then they'll make a move.
So you two are agreeing now, but you won't be for long, because it's time for the fabled Stats Showdown.
Stats Showdown.
So here we are in the middle of the desert. George has a duster on. Mo has a lovely hat, a cowboy hat, not just a regular snapback or anything.
And a poncho.
Is that your go-to hat?
My regular hat.
Sign of the times, isn't it?
My regular hat.
Not a regular hat, like a snapback.
I wear a cowboy hat, yeah. that's what Mo's wearing. George, like I said, just has a leather duster and nothing else. armed with their stat guns, ready to supply me with some knockout stat knowledge that I'm going to plagiarize and make myself seem incredibly knowledgeable somewhere over the rainbow where people need football stats. First up this week, Mo, it's your first time on. I'm going to let you take the first stat shot.
Thank
at
you.
George.
Okay. No London Premier League club scored last weekend. Yeah, no London club scored in the Premier League last weekend. That's the last time that happened, sorry, was the 25th round of the 2008-09 season, when Chelsea drew 0-0 with Hull, Spurs drew 0-0 with Arsenal, West Ham lost 1-0 to Man United, and Wigan drew 0-0 with Fulham.
You can tell he's a newbie, can't you? He's mentioned a West Ham loss in his stat.
Have I made a mistake there?
But I mean, if you're going to mention a West Ham stat, it's more than likely it's going to be a loss, isn't it?
I'll make it up to you, don't worry.
George, stat me.
So I'm going to talk about the topical team, I'd say, in the Premier League at the moment, in Crystal Palace.
Oh.
Who are obviously bottom of the league. And this isn't my stat, but I think they've broken the record for the most time at the beginning of a season without scoring. But despite not scoring yet this season, despite being bottom of the league, Crystal Palace have had 38 shots taken in the opposition's area. That is sixth in the Premier League and two more than Chelsea.
Hmm. Wow.
But most of them came in that one game, didn't they?
I've moved Mo to a wow.
You moved Mo to a wow. But I sort of bowed my head at Mo's stat. Because it is weird that none of the London teams scored. So I'm going to give round one to the Mo.
Machine gun.
The Mo-shee gun. The Mofo show. George, are you going to fire back at him?
Yeah.
With vigour?
Yeah, so
it's better be vigorous.
Obviously, Liverpool, again, another team in the news at the moment for their abject display in the draw against Burnley. Philippe Coutinho is returning in that game, and he had seven shots in the 78 minutes. One was taken in the box, six were taken outside. At the beginning of last season, Burnley beat Liverpool 2-0 in a very similar game. In that game, Coutinho had eight shots, seven were outside the box, and one was on target. So over the two games, he's had 15 shots, of which one's been on target, and only two have been inside the box.
130 million. It's a good stat. Mo, what you got?
Oh, you're going to like this one.
Oh, I better.
Andy Carroll hasn't scored more than 10 Premier League goals in a single season since 2010-11, but he has assisted or scored a goal every 180 minutes when fit during that period.
Mo's apparently the only person who can tell when Andy Carroll's fit.
180 minutes is quite a long time. And Andy Carroll is quite good. I know, because I've seen him. He's effective. Also, I mean, I would say that was sucking up to the host. George, you've equalised.
Thank you. Sorry, Coutinho. I've slagged off Philippe Coutinho so many times in this room. It's good that it's finally won me a point.
Your chance to kill George with stats.
All right.
It's nigh, Mo. This is your chance.
This is a bit of a sledgehammer, this one. actually spawned by a bit of Twitter beef actually that I was having on Sunday. Since the start of last season, since he started playing a number nine, Edinson Cavani's had 81 shots from big chances. That's the highest across Europe's top five leagues and 26 more than second place. His 39 goals from big chances is also the highest, right? So you think that's impressive? Yeah, okay, fine. But his 48 big chance conversion rate places him 92nd across all players in Europe's top five leagues. That's behind Radamel Falcao, Lionel Messi, and even Troy Deeney, who has got 50% big chance conversion rate.
So you're telling me that Cavani misses a lot of chances.
Big chances.
I'm going to say here is that's not news to me.
I thought the interesting bit of that is that Troy Deeney is very
Troy Deeney is the interesting part.
Yeah.
Seven goals from 14 big chances since the start of last season. Big Troy.
George, I think you've got him on the ropes. You've let me down before.
I've gone for a weird one again because I know you like weird ones.
Here we go. Everyone's got wacky hats on, cowboy hats, ponchos.
So there have been 450 minutes so far in the Premier League.
Oh my God.
Brilliant. The outfield player, that should have been it.
I was impressed enough.
The outfield player with the worst passing accuracy with 55% is Christian Benteke, who's only completed 67 passes in 450 minutes. That is the worst. That's the fewest passes completed of anyone who's been ever present this season, only because Harry Kane has been taken off for 20 minutes. Otherwise, he'd have won it with 64.
That Harry Kane thing, I think that swung it for me. The Harry Kane at the end. Mo, you went ahead, but
I brought the Troy Deeney then. I thought Big Troy, you had done for me.
You'll be eternally behind for this week.
Sorry,
anyway.
It's his first time. We went easy on him. It's good.
Oh, God. George, too cocky. George, where can people find you gloating on the internet?
I'll be cracking on right now. Yeah, so on at George Ehlek, ELEK, on Twitter. You can find me there. No one knows how to spell my surname, so ELEK is the way to do it.
And Mo, where can we find your scathing replies to George?
At Mohammed Bott on Twitter, MUHAMMAD, because no one can spell my first name. So.
And you can find me at Rob Armstrong _WH. And you can find this podcast on Deezer, on iTunes, where I know you're absolutely begging to subscribe to it, as well as rate and review it in a positive way, of course. And we'll see you next time on Defending in Numbers.
Defending in Numbers is a Deezer Originals production. You can find and download more episodes on Deezer and all major podcast providers.